I'm coming.
They've already said, don't try and grow rhododendrons if you don't have acid soil. Grow lilacs instead.
Read Philip, left hand column. Never heard of that. Doesn't sound worth bothering with. Very short cutting, low flowering. They're a bit skinny, aren't they? They're gorgeous pots, aren't they? Subtle colours.
For larger shrinking shrubs, wooden containers like their size help.
there's something for every taste and every pocket as well. From tiny little pots that can fit on hangings that go onto drain pipes or trellises. There are massive containers that cost a fortune with terracotta.
Looks like Helen in the background.
With a profusion of Victorian subtropical bedding. Something for everybody. If you spend a lot on terracotta, it pays to look after it. And that means improving the drainage. Don't just pack it full of garden soil, because even if you've bought phosphorus terracotta, which you always should, it expands and it freezes in winter, and that can result in flaking and cracking. One of the important things is to get the whole container up off the ground so water can really escape. And rather than use bricks, you can use these little terracotta feet, which make the whole thing look more attractive. And when it comes to planting, make sure you put plenty of drainage material in the bottom, either broken clay pots or these expanded clay pebbles. They want to go in about 2 inches deep at least, and then some compost on the top of that. Now, I used to use a John Innes with added peat and grit just to improve the structure and drainage. But now I'm going to try the coconut fibre compost just to see how it does. I've never tried it in containers before, so this is something of an experiment. I'm going to use a margarita as the central part, that large geranthemum and frutescens. But as most containers are only seen from one side, you don't really need to put that bed in the middle. Just a bit more compost there to raise it up. And I'm going to use a colour theme of white, a sort of yellowy colour with a penicrysum here, and blue petunias, rather than just use a mass of colour, arranging them all around the edge. And I might just put one either to trail over the front so that we've got a little bit of covering over the pot. For a container this size, I've used the one large
one. It's pretty, isn't it?
Now I like to cram them in. You could get away with using four or five smaller ones around the front. But if you water and feed well, there's plenty there for them to really grow and expand. So you'll get a nice big ball of flower and leaf colour there.
What that
it will appreciate quite a funny
position. That's the trouble, it costs a lot of money.
In a container, one way of doing this is to grow climates which you can train up bamboo canes, either two tied together with wire at the top, or a wigwam maybe three or four. This is the golden hop, which is safely allowed to stay in here permanently. But you can use seasonal plants like
wheatgreens
or cutting short of or even black-eyed
susan. Well, we could do that in the oak container out there. There were two different ivies in that, weren't there? And chrysanthemum.
Like
lettuce. Radicchio. Sort of geranium cross with ivy.
I always plant one or two hanging baskets every year to brighten up the outside of the house. And whereas it's traditional to use sphagnum moss, I'm going to try out this new coconut fibre lining, which I think is going to be very effective. It looks good, and I don't think it will dry out any quicker than moss. But to help it, I'll be putting a square of black plastic, any sort of polythene will do, into the centre, just to help it retain moisture so that when it's watered, it won't all drain straight through. Next, a layer
that's
of
a funny idea.
In the base,
make it waterlogged.
So that I can start putting my plants through the sides. The good thing about this basket is that there are gaps in the liner so that plants can go through. I'm going to put three different sorts through the sides. One of them is white trailing azalea. I would push my plants through from the outside and just slip them on the compost underneath. I'm also going to use pink impatiens, which is a bit more of a struggle because they've got quite large roots here. So I shall just lose some of that compost without damaging the roots too much. Find a suitable opening and push through to be strong delicate.
That's pink. It looks purple to me.
Push the plant through from the inside. And the other sort I'm going to be using is a variegated glaucoma. Now this is a wonderful plant because it trails right down in long strands and really gives you a nice length of the plant in the basket. You can usually split these up, which is quite good, so you get...
Was it called dracoma?
I have to move again some of that root. Find another hole. That will tolerate light shade, but if you've got a really shady plant, slice them
I love
here
that.
and make quite long strands pushed through the sides. Having got all the plants around the sides, I always then start from the middle and work outwards. So I use the tallest plant, the geraniums I've chosen here, to go in the centre. And then work outwards from there. These guys grow quite tall. You could use tall fuchsias or any sort of plant in the centre there. But around the outside of those will go the nice pink petunias, which spread out beautifully in the hanging basket. And I'll alternate those with a nice silver foliage plant called Cinerarium rutila. So I'll have a nice collection of silver, white and pink in there.
A well plant, properly planted basket uses an awful lot of plants, doesn't it?
Created in 250 acres of new forest wood on the banks of the Beaulieu River to provide a home for one of the finest collections.
Can you turn it up a bit, please?
Azaleas, anywhere. It's the fulfillment of one man's dream, the Lionel de Rothschild, with a passionate
Thank
collector
you.
And hybridizer of these plants, some of the most compellingly beautiful of all flowering shrubs. Today, Lionel's passion continues in his son, Edmund de Rothschild. Edmund, your father describes himself as a banker by hobby and a gardener by profession.
Oh, well, it's always rumoured to have said that. Whether that's true or not, they will never know. It's one of those good stories.
Yes.
It's a story.
But clearly he had a passion for plants from an early age.
He did. He hated hunting and shooting. And also he liked motor cars and motorboat racing. And he had a friend down here, John Montague. And he came to live down here, and that's how really it all started. Because he suddenly found that down here, the climate was reasonably warm, and flowers would grow. There was a band of horticulturists, like Abba Conway and Abra Hedgevillier and various others, who got teams together to go out to the far corners of the earth to collect plants.
That
grew in the areas where the frost line is. And so many seeds were brought back. And that is how the species were generated and was brought back. Then these ardent horticulturists decided that they would show against each other, and then the best ones were chosen by my father to make these wonderful hybrids, which form the backbone of this garden, although he also has a good collection of the species. In making the garden, 250 acres in extent, 10 miles of paths and 22 miles of water pipe. He had 200 men working for him.
200?
They all double dug the garden, and he then personally supervised the planting. And he then made the crosses. I don't know whether he actually physically did them himself, but perhaps his head gardener did. Anyhow, he knew how to do it, just as my head gardener stayed at it, because he was continuing to.
Today, you presumably don't have 200 gardens here.
I have six plus one and a half. One the itself, the half being my dear wife.
And obviously you are actively involved, but your father being such a pioneering horticulturist, he must have been in gardening terms a hard act to follow.
It's only really recently that I've become more interested in the work of replanting the garden so that the public could see it. The gardens are in a my charitable foundation, and are preserved.
Isn't that lovely?
Expert for many years, I would have thought this must be as good a place as anywhere in the world for growing rhododendrons and azaleas. It certainly is. We have a sheltered garden, we have acid soil, and also a relatively mild climate. Now, these are some of the early Exbury hybrids that Lionel bred between the walls.
That's correct. And what he did, really, was to bring seedlings from the Knaphill nurseries and cross them with rhododendron moral to get these better, clearer colours.
That's what he was looking for, was it? Essentially better colour?
Yes, and also better form.
What about perfume?
Well, sadly, perfume wasn't on Lionel's shopping list.
And hardiness, because these are clearly bred for a mild garden, but they actually have relevance for the rest of the country.
Well, they're the plant is deciduous, so it is hardy, but further north, the young shoots on this plant can get cut back by early spring frosts, so they can be a problem.
But even so, even if they're not bone hardy, and even if they don't have perfume, you can't deny that's a very lovely flower.
I tend to think of the yellower to browny shade as being azalea rather than rhododendron. White, pink, red into purple rhododendron. There are indeed, yes, but you don't seem to get the yellows into rhododendrons, do you? Yes. Of the lovely purplier variety. When you get such a splodge of colour, it's difficult to know just how well adjusted your colour level is on the television.
It's probably heresy for me to say it at a place like Exbury, but I'm not sure I don't actually prefer rhododendrons to azaleas even, and that is the reason why. That is a stunning group, isn't it?
Yeah, that is a group of rhododendron arboreum hybrids. They've been planted here many years ago.
Which particular ones are those, do we know?
Well, sadly, they were never named. They were just planted.
What that underlines, though, to me, is that something that many people don't appreciate, and that's that some rhododendrons, when they grow up, become full-sized trees, don't they?
Well, they certainly do. And I think that is a good example, you can see.
I'm interested you said these were never named, because I know that some of the Exbury rhododendron hybrids were named, and in fact, became very famous.
Probably the most famous of all was probably rhododendron hawk crest. Lionel de Rothschild was searching for the clear yellow rhododendron, and this gene, although created it in the 40s, didn't plant for some 10 years after his death. So he never saw the true yellow that he wanted to create so much.
Poignant story, isn't it? Before we came to this part of the garden, I think you called it Witcher's Wood. Which interests me, because that's not witches as in broomstick, is it?
No, it's not. The Witcher family used to inhabit this wood. They were a family of tinkers or Romanies, and lived in this wood in bygone times.
Which underlines, of course, the fact that this is a garden built on an old forest site, and obviously provides lovely conditions for the rhododendron hybrids. But the species too, you have a good collection of species. I spotted Augustinii, but there are many others, aren't there?
There certainly are. Bearing in mind this garden was being created between the wars, and Lionel brought back many species from various parts.
Interesting colouring at the top.
And used them here for his hybridisation programme and planted them here at Exbury.
Very.
It occurs to me, Terry, that looking at the rhododendron genus as a whole, you've actually got almost every colour in the spectrum, haven't you?
Yes, we have. Well, apart from the elusive true blue.
Yes, I don't really think even that matters, because that very near blue of Augustinii looks lovely with that pink Naomi.
It does.
And I guess that was probably a planting combination that occurred by accident. But this is a deliberate one, isn't it?
It certainly is. The yellow and blue are the Rothschild racing colours. And you see many of them planted at the garden here.
Well, they do actually go together. But there's something for everyone, from the pastel shades of the big species rhododendrons to the really vibrant striped colours of the hybrid azaleas. Really something for every taste.
No, I'm afraid I don't.
You can buy a little kit, can't you, in the chemist's shops and test it. Apparently they weren't growing lime-based soil.
that lovely?
The green that makes it, isn't it?
Yes. Extraordinary colouring. Extraordinary. Now's the time one ought to be out and about seeing that sort of thing. This is the season. Yes, Linda loved it at Savile Garden last weekend. Weekend before.
This is one of the very vibrant coloured solan strain of Expery Azalea. And how have these arisen? Where have they come from?
Lurid.
These have come from selections from Land of Rothschild's earlier crossings. And tell me, how long does it take from finding a little seedling to growing a plant to a size where you can say, yes, that's a good plant, we'll persevere with it? Between 15 and 20 years. Well, as long as that. Oh yes, and here's another one, another striking and coloured one. But tell me, are you raising these new varieties simply further to beautify Expery, or is this to give people plants they can grow in their own gardens?
It is to produce plants that are available to people's gardens.
And so what particular merits do these have in addition to this obviously more vibrant colour? Are they hardier?
Much hardier, yes, and as you say, much more colourful.
So where do you go from here? You've brought the old Expery hybrids up to date. What's the next goal?
We would like to bring in more fragrance into these azaleas, but we feel that's the missing part.
Well, I'm sure if you can do that, if you can get fragrance into a plant that is obviously so visually beautiful, then I don't think there'll be any doubt that if people want to see the genus Rhododendron in the full range of its splendour, fragrance and colour, then Expery is clearly the place to come to.
That's a beautiful color,
well,
like,
isn't it? I'd like to see the gardens continue. I'd like people to come and enjoy the garden.
Or just walk in a peaceful atmosphere. Mm. Beautiful. Beautiful.
If you've got a large garden, you can afford to leave your spring bedding in and plant the summer bedding around it. But if your space is small, like here in the ornamental kitchen garden, then the spring bedding has to come out to make space for the summer stuff.
I don't want
to throw these tulips away. And if I look after them properly, they'll produce good bulbs for next year. What I'll do is to heel those into a shallow trench in the corner so that the sun can help to build up the bulb, and then I'll feed them with general fertilizer and not lift those bulbs and store them until the foliage has died down completely. And it's much the same story with polyanthus. You can lift these out carefully and divide them, and they'll produce good plants for next year. That's just a case of splitting them up by hand, planting them out into nursery rows in some odd corner of the garden, give them a bit of a feed again, and they'll produce really good plants for planting out in the autumn and flowering in the spring.
Well, with the area clear and revitalised
with a bucket full of compost, I can now plant my summer bedding. But before I do, I want to add just a little bit of fertiliser. And the operative phrase here is a little bit. If you put on too much, then you'll get all leaf and no flower. You can use a rose fertilizer, or if you're organic like me, a little bit of this pelleted chicken manure, and then you're ready for planting. At the back there, because it's a nice sunny spot, I'm using petunias, which are quite tall plants, and planting in very informal drifts in this garden. I don't want it to look like the park. Just put them in. At the front here, I'm going to plant a few fibrous-rooted begonias just to make a change. And they'll be planted right up to the edge of the path. And hang over the path and look rather good.
Beautifully prepared soil. I mean, you try that without soil, you damage your fingers. It's like a flipping rock. Not with your fingers, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
Of course, the sunny spots are the easy places. Shady places are much more difficult in more ways than one. There aren't a lot of bedding plants that will grow in shady spots.
Do you want to go and hear the jazz tonight?
Certainly, I've been very successful with. Now, when you go to the garden centre to buy bedding plants, do bear in mind that the growers bring them on into flower early, really.
But the earlier that they come into flower, then the earlier they're going to go out of flower. So if you can find something a little less advanced than this, then so much the better. And these impatiens will go around the tree in the middle here. There are one or two other good plants that you can use. Mimulus is certainly good, but I don't think it's going to go here. It's just a little bit too bright for this situation. So on the edges of this little bit of border, I shall be using the blue lobelia with a white eye, and this is Clibran, which I think will go very well with this impatiens. It'll give me a nice show right away through the summer until the first.
It's a very pleasant little show without the blue, isn't it?
Well, a few weeks ago we asked you some knotty horticultural questions and offered you £25,000 worth of mowers and other machinery. Well, that competition has now been judged, and we had winners from as far apart as Falmouth to Merseyside. All those are announced in the current issue of the Radio Times. And the answers? Well, we asked you what fruit was poisonous, a potato, a rose, or a cotoneaster. Well, of course, it's the potato fruit that is poisonous. Autumn fruiting raspberries should be pruned in the spring. You put tea bags into your watering can when you're watering rhododendrons, of course, to make the water acid. And the petiole is a leaf stalk. I hope you won. Well, if you miss that competition, there's still time to enter the Gardeners World magazine Gardens in Focus competition and win Pentax cameras. The closing date for that is July the 29th, and all the details are in the current issue of the Gardeners World magazine. Well, next week, Stefan visits a fabulous garden in Gloucestershire. Great gardening ideas there. Pippa Greenwood starts on her quest to find a solution to the problem of cats. Nigel Coburn will be here continuing creatively planting, and this week he's going up the wall with climbers. And of course I'll be back here at Barnsdale with all the seasonal work that you should be doing in your garden.
Pardon me.
The only comment on the rhododendron came in the first 30 seconds.
On how to grow them, you mean?
Yes.
Plenty of comment otherwise on them.
Yes.
Really?
Lilac come in other colours besides burnt and white.
I've never heard of it.
And on CFAX on page 617.
Reputation, expertise, and instinct. The arcane stock and trade of the successful dealer.
Will I take a chance on affiliating you to the gallery by letting you have one of these?
What's going to follow here?
Really arrogant, but it really, it's true. Anybody who gets one of these paintings is receiving a prize.
It's an excellent time for dealers. Relative value.
Real McCoy.
Sounds rather hard.
Good evening. Ethiopia is facing a famine of catastrophic proportions, and the world.
Well, it always is, isn't it?
They appeal to the men who have taken over the country to help. The relief convoys cannot get through to many of the starving because roads have been cut and bandits attack their lorries. In some areas, food warehouses have been looted. International aid workers say they have been encouraged by promises of action from the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Front, but they will have to act quickly. Otherwise, more than 7 million people may starve to death. The famine stretches far and wide.
You're supposed to announce the headlines first.
2 million people are classed as needing immediate assistance. In neighboring Tigray, the figure is 2.5 million. Across the country's heartland, another 1 million. In these regions, relief operations are still running after a fashion, but in the south and southeast, nothing is getting through. Around 2 million people are on the brink of starvation here. And now 400,000 refugees from Sudan have added to the crisis.
They were rebels until this week. Now they're the government of the poorest and hungriest nation on earth.
job.
Today they called a meeting of all the international aid agencies whose operations have been crippled by the war. In the incongruous setting of the Hilton Ballroom, they listened as the agencies told them the lives of millions of people were now in their hands.
By air, these children will die very quickly if they're not reached within the next, really, week.
In the southwest, and especially here in the east, hard against the Somali border, 1.5 million starving people are getting no food supplies. This was Kebri Bayar less than a month ago. It's even worse further south. Somalis who fled into Ethiopia, trying to escape one terrible war, now victims of another. They were dying when some food was getting through. Now, no food at all is reaching them. Stocks that still exist are being looted by government troops. And nobody knows for sure what's happening.
People are dying in large numbers. I was in a camp there last week, and they were telling me there were 10 children dying per day.
They live there.
Well, we're going to see
a
very large number of deaths.
They've driven away from their homes. Yes. Famine, the army, I mean, lack of rain and all that sort of thing.
Now it's just whether they can actually pull it off.
The rebels already run relief operations under cover of dark during the war in from Sudan to the mountains of Tigray. When I travelled with them 1 year ago, they had managed to prevent famine in the north, despite government planes that attacked any vehicle moving by day. They have a reputation for being efficient, of working with the local people more effectively than the former government's relief officials. But those were their own people, and they controlled the areas they operated in. Now they've suddenly inherited the whole country. There's a power vacuum in the south, armed and dangerous men everywhere, and thousands of lives at stake over the next few weeks. It's difficult enough restoring order to the capital. The new administration has instructed that all weapons should be handed in. They're collecting them outside the back of the Ministry of Defense. The pile of Russian assault rifles is growing by the hour.
Good grief.
But the city's awash with guns.
Think of the money that was spent on that lot.
It's far worse outside Addis, where the rebels have not yet gained control and anarchy rules. There have been many demonstrations outside the capital, this today at Akaki in the south. They weren't against the rebels. They were glad the old regime was gone, but they were angry that Ethiopia might be split up. There were no rebel forces in the area, and it passed off peacefully. One more problem, though, for Ethiopia's new rulers.
Yep.
Michael Burke, BBC News, Addis Ababa.
Here, the Northern Ireland Secretary Peter Brook has said that efforts to get the Ulster talks going will continue, even though the Unionists have said they won't accept Lord Carrington as an independent chairman. Today, Mr. Brook flew to Dublin and had 4 hours of talks with the Irish Foreign Minister, but they didn't come up with another suggestion. The Unionist parties have given the British government a list of 9 possible names. Mr. Brook said that was helpful.
Peter Brook went to Dublin to see if he and the Irish ministers could agree on a new candidate to be the independent chairman who'll sit in on talks between the Ulster parties and the Republic's government. As it turned out, they didn't pick a new name. Their meeting, though, was effectively a start to picking up the pieces after the fiasco of Lord Carrington's rejection for the role.
David's picking up about 2 tomorrow. Yep. No. I don't suppose we'll be there for more than 2 or 3 hours.
If a candidate acceptable to all sides isn't found very soon, Mr. Brook may have no choice but to adjourn the talks process until there is an agreed nominee.
In Spain, anti-terrorist police are questioning a 22-year-old student from the Irish Republic after a car bomb attack on Wednesday at Vic near Barcelona. They're trying to find out if he has any links with the IRA. 9 people were killed in the attack on a civil guard barracks. No group has admitted the bombing, but
old film.
The Basque separatist group ETA. The Education Minister, Tim Egger, has told the National Association of Head Teachers annual conference that changes will be made to the new system of tests for seven-year-olds. He admitted there were problems to be ironed out, but he said the tests were here to stay. Yesterday, the conference voted for them to be abolished.
There's been strong pressure from teachers to see an end to tests for seven-year-olds. Today's government announcement of changes comes after widespread complaints that the amount of work involved is unmanageable and has caused disruption in the classroom.
He doesn't seem to be using that very profitably.
Have roughly twice the amount of time to carry out the tests next summer, and there'll be talks with teachers to find out what other changes are needed. Members of the National Association of Head Teachers meeting in Scarborough welcomed the Education Minister's admission that there were problems to be ironed out. Not so welcome, though, was his insistence that the tests were here to stay.
What I've suggested is a number of ways in which we might simplify the tests next year to make them more manageable, while also being fair to children. It's very important that the tests are fair to children and identify the children's strengths and weaknesses.
But teachers are not impressed with the planned changes, which they say don't go far enough.
I think when one hears of our primary colleagues, I'm a secondary head, and one hears of the problems in their schools, that one realises that time is not perfected. It's the very nature of the tests themselves that seems to be the problem.
We understand they're going to be modified next year and then remodified the year after. This continual readjustment of the goalposts is only going to create further and further demoralisation.
Despite this partial climb down by the government, teachers are not placated. Their message is the system won't work and should be abandoned. They say continuous assessment by them is the answer.
President Bush has said he's now more confident about giving economic aid to the Soviet Union. He was speaking after he'd had a meeting with senior Soviet officials at the White House. It's thought they'd outlined important changes to the economy. Gorbachev wants to be invited to a meeting of leaders of the Group of Seven industrialized countries in London next month to discuss his proposals. It's thought the Soviet Union wants massive new financial aid and the rescheduling of the country's debts, entry into organizations such as the World Bank and the IMF, and an end to Western trade restrictions. The reforms they're offering include privatization of Soviet state-owned factories, decentralization of economic power, and strict financial policies to control inflation.
The Soviet side calls it a grand bargain. Western economic assistance helping their reforms and therefore promoting international security. But Soviet envoy Yevgeny Primakov came to a sceptical Washington, intent on exacting a political price for any aid.
Those are nonsense,
isn't it? US sources speak of attaching strings, like the Soviets demonstrating their commitment to free market reform, cutting Moscow's aid to Cuba, easing up on the Baltic republics, and more military cutbacks.
Sacking half the army would be a good start.
Afterwards, Mr. Primakov pronounced himself satisfied and yet was vague on details, though he indicated economic reforms were somehow guaranteed.
I do believe that we have a lot of guarantees because we are doing our best to pass this way towards the market first, and you could watch our move.
Mr. Primakov claimed Washington was not opposed to inviting President Gorbachev to July's G7 economic summit in London. His country's needs, he said, were clear.
Patience first and understanding second.
With some easing of arms control problems, Mr. Primakov hoped there might be a superpower summit soon. For his part, President Bush said he was very impressed that Moscow seemed prepared to face the pain of real economic reforms, but he is still considering the aid question.
I liked what I heard, and we have some decisions ahead of us, and I'm not going to project those decisions. I'm not going to suggest that my mind is made up. Nor is the administration position yet firmed up on a wide array of matters with the Soviets.
Conservatives here argue against what some have called the taxpayers' bailout of communism. And the CIA also has its doubts about Soviet reforms. As CIA Director William Webster put it, Moses did not reach the promised land. This may also be the case with Gorbachev. Gavin Esper, BBC News, at the White House.
Soviet officials admit that foreign investment of hundreds of billions of pounds is needed for the country's move towards a free market economy. But they've warned the West against imposing too many conditions in return for that financial aid.
In the midst of a cornfield in Kazakhstan, President Gorbachev chatted and joked with local farmers. The Central Asian Republic is an important supplier of grain and other raw materials. Many of these farmers have abandoned the old state-run system and set up cooperatives, winning the approval of President Gorbachev, who thanked them for their excellent produce. But his program of economic change is in deep trouble, and the Soviet leader sees the meeting of the seven leading industrialized nations as a key opportunity to seek help from the West.
Now that we're starting a phase of decisive change, we have to take practical steps to synchronize our economic reforms with the programs of Western countries. I would like to share my ideas about this with the representatives of G7.
This week, the Supreme Soviet passed a draft law allowing wholly foreign-owned firms to operate here for the first time in Soviet history. They'll be able to import and export goods and take their profits out of the country, a move which could help to convince Britain and the United States that genuine change is underway. Prime Minister Valentin Pavlov said the country needed investment equivalent to several hundred billion pounds. That's much higher than most Western estimates.
The Kremlin is anxious to demonstrate its determination to press ahead with economic reform, aware that aid from the seven industrialized nations will not be forthcoming without it. In practice, the old bureaucracy still creates enormous problems for anyone trying to do business here, and some of the new laws have caused only confusion.
There's what is known as a war of laws. The republics have one law, and the old union government has another law. And there's nobody to tell them which law they should be following, and this makes doing business here very risky, obviously.
Despite the difficulties, a number of joint ventures like this Swiss-Soviet shop have been formed recently. The result is an Aladdin's cave in comparison with almost any other shop here. Payment is in dollars only, but it's an illustration that Western investment in the Soviet Union can work. Carol Walker, BBC News, Moscow.
The head of the airport authority in Thailand has said that an engine fire might have been to blame for the crash of a Lauda Air jet on Sunday. But the manufacturers Pratt & Whitney said there was no evidence to suggest a problem with the engines. All 223 people on board the plane died in the crash. Investigators say information from the 767's flight recorder has yet to be analysed. A telephone helpline has been set up to help people who have to wait a long time to get into hospital. There are now more than 1 million people waiting for operations, 40,000 more than in 1989. And in some parts of the country, nearly 1 in 3 of those on the list have to wait for more than a year.
Getting a bed for anything other than emergency or acute surgery has become even harder, today's report shows. There has been a reduction in those waiting longest for an operation, 2 years or more, but a year's delay is still common. And that, says the College of Health, can be painful.
I mean, the stories that you hear every day are dreadful. Of course, I'm not saying all patients on hospital waiting lists are in such a plight, but a great many are, far too many.
Darren Gale, his parents were told, must wait up to 3 years for an ear operation. It meant a bright little boy falling behind at school and putting strain on all around him.
Strain on my wife because Darren was extremely frustrated. The patient was coming out in temper in that he could not communicate properly in terms of speech, which should have been there, just a mumbling blur.
In the Gale family's health authority, Northeast Thames, where cash cuts have led to closed wards, 30% of patients must wait longer than a year for surgery. While in the Mersey Health Region, only 9% of those on the list suffer a year's delay.
And you're waiting for a hip replacement operation.
The new College of Health hotline aims to spread the load.
Are you willing to go anywhere in the country? You are.
It pinpoints where the delays are shortest. The government is funding it and says it nicely complements the health service reforms.
In the past, the way it was organised, the funding, the waiting lists, were often shrouded, if not in secrecy, you just couldn't get the information. And one of the things that we're doing in the reforms is trying to explain to people how it works and how we can make sure that the funding and the work undertaken are better matched.
I welcome the fact that the government is now funding a hotline and we're going to have a telephone to find out where the shortest waiting lists are. But I do beds at shop.
And GPs raise another doubt. Under the new market-style NHS, will they be free to refer cases to any hospital anywhere, or be tied to the hospitals their own district authority has to finance, however long the waiting lists?
GPs will be happy to refer patients to anywhere where they can get an operation done more quickly, if that's what they wish. But the commissioning authorities may not have the money to pay for that out of district referrals.
What most patients really want, doctors say, is to have their operation not just promptly, but close to home as well.
Two new inquiries have been set up into allegations that children in local authority care have been ill-treated. Council inquiry will be held into reports that methods similar to pin-down were used at a youth care centre near Falkirk in central Scotland. And the Welsh office has ordered an inquiry into a children's home in Gwent after claims of brutality against children there.
The Tŷ Mawr Children's Home near Abergavenny in Gwent is the focus of the most serious allegations. It's been claimed that children have been verbally humiliated and confined alone to cells for several hours, and four teenagers are said to have attempted suicide here. It's alleged that after 15-year-old Philip Knight was discovered with a slashed wrist, management at the home wanted police to bring criminal charges against him for damaging his room. A month later, he hanged himself at Swansea Prison. The Welsh office has ordered an independent inquiry into the Tŷ Mawr allegations and a review of the running of all its children's homes.
I think we do have to remember that Tŷ Mawr and other homes are dealing with very difficult, disturbed youngsters in many cases, many of whom have already been before the courts, and the courts have very particular problems there. But it's absolutely right, I believe, that we should ensure that anybody who's placed in the custody of a children's home, for whatever reason, should be under a proper regime of care. And these allegations really must be investigated.
But there's another inquiry tonight in Scotland following allegations of a regime similar to pin-down at the Brodie Youth Care Centre in Polmont. An anonymous member of staff has claimed that teenage troublemakers and absconders were punished by being stripped of their underwear and confined to their rooms for up to 24 hours.